This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University professor Michael Gizzi says the Supreme Court decision confirming the Trump Muslim travel ban to the U.S. passes constitutional muster.
It's one of those opinions you read the majority and say, yeah, okay, he's right. Then you read the dissent and you say, yep, she's absolutely right.
But Gizzi tells GLT's Eric Stock it's terrible policy. Plus, reducing commercial food waste could help landfills, the environment, and everyone's garden. Eric Stock has more. And John Norton gives us the music of A Band of Heathens. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The National Resource Defense Council estimates up to 40% of all food produced in the U.S. goes to waste, even though 1 in 8 Americans struggles to put enough food on the table. GLT's Eric Stock looks into the causes of food waste in America, what some local restaurateurs, producers, and charities are doing to reduce food waste, and how a new state law is helping some farmers find new uses for some of its produce that might otherwise end up in a landfill.
Chef Ken Mischke is in one of his three kitchens at Epiphany Farms restaurant in Bloomington as his staff prepares for the night's customers. As an environmentally conscious owner of three farm-to-table restaurants in McLean County, Mischke hates to throw out any food at all.
Most kitchens that I go in that I'm not managing, I see so much waste just from neglect of taking the 30 seconds to scrape out the pan.
Mischke symbolizes this through what he calls a million-dollar spatula. It's an exaggeration, he admits, but the point is clear. Don't waste a single drop.
If you do a good job of scraping out all the pots and pans and every time you make a recipe or every time you change a container with a spatula, then over the life of that spatula, that thing could become worth up to $1 million.
Mischke conveys his food waste mantra to his customers. Servers write the date on customers' carryout boxes so they have a reminder of how long they have to eat it. He says limiting food waste is especially challenging when working with raw produce, which typically has a one-week shelf life. But he says whether it's pork, eggs, or radishes, anything that's been sitting for more than a few days ends up in what he calls the family meal, which happens daily at each of his restaurants, Epiphany Farms at Anjou Above in Bloomington, at Old Bank in Leroy, and at his farm in Downs. Staff prepares a meal for all of his 165 employees with the food that's showing some age but still good. That keeps the food for his customers the freshest, and there's an added benefit.
It's the base of our culture. It's like, you know, a happy family sits down and has a meal together, and they have a conversation, and they get to know each other, and they enjoy a meal, and that's really what this is all about.
Food waste isn't just a problem in restaurants. It's a major issue for grocery stores. Mike Hoffman, logistics director at Midwest Food Bank at Normal, says we, the consumers, are largely to blame.
If you go to the grocery store and you have two pieces of fruit in front of you, one has a slight blemish on it and one doesn't have any blemish on it, we're all going to take the one with this perfect. We like everything really nice, right?
It's gotten to the point, Hoffman says, stores will turn away entire truckloads of apples, for example, because some look less than perfect, perhaps proving the old adage that one bad apple really can spoil a whole barrel.
It boils down to you and me, the average consumer, who's saying, look, there's nothing wrong with that fruit, but we all want the best. And that's kind of the way we are in America. We've been groomed that way.
That's where agencies like Midwest Food Bank step in. Food haulers turned away from the stores will deliver their still perfectly good produce to the food bank and its new 100,000-square-foot warehouse, where it gets repackaged into family-sized containers that can feed families for weeks. Several dozen food banks in McLean County come in weekly to pick up truckloads of food to deliver to families in need. It's an effort that relies heavily on volunteers.
The group repackaging thing. I think they're repackaging cereal today.
Midwest volunteers put in 220,000 hours of free labor at each of its eight locations in the U.S. and Kenya, all so the good food doesn't go to waste while many go hungry.
There's a lot of waste out there, and we're recovering as much as we can. I'm just thankful for every piece of food that's in this warehouse that we can give out that way, because that's something that's not going into landfills, not getting wasted. And the bigger picture is we are serving people that are in need, that need a little help.
There are other charities which help to distribute food that might otherwise be destined for the landfill. Isaac Simmons is a volunteer for Veggie Oasis. Each week, he and other volunteers arrive at the end of Bloomington's weekly farmers market, hauling a wheelbarrow, offering to take the merchant's leftover produce to give to families in need. Simmons says he saw firsthand how many families were struggling with access to healthy food when he worked at the market last year.
That kind of woke me up to the food insecurity of Bloomington Normal. And it got me talking with the farmers, and then I got in contact with Veggie Oasis.
Simmons, who is a student at Illinois Wesleyan, majoring in business and religion, says he often leaves with up to 3 wheelbarrows full of prepared food, fruits, and vegetables.
I feel amazing about it, but I don't. I try not to put like how I feel about it into it, because it's really just something that should happen normally. So this is just something that should happen that I'm doing.
That food is then delivered to the West Bloomington Revitalization Project offices, where it's placed on tables outside for anyone to take, no questions asked. It's typically gone within an hour. Tony Maluski of Bloomington says the Veggie Oasis has given her family the chance to have a healthier diet.
It's a great help to us. It's really cut our food budget and allows us to spend money on other things that we need. It allows us to try new foods without being out much money.
And the mother of 3 is often amused by what her 3 preteens want to take home and try, like okra, eggplant, and a Mexican turnip called jicama.
They pick whatever they want, and they've picked some pretty adventurous stuff, and then we take it home and we have to figure out how to prepare it and how to cook it. And we've found a lot of new things that we've tried to make part of our weekly diet, like kale chips was a popular one.
And therein lies the challenge for some families, knowing what to do with the foods with which they have little familiarity. That alone can be a turnoff. Armando Baez works for the West Bloomington Revitalization Project and has created what you would call an urban farm at his home just a few blocks east of downtown, where he grows everything from cucumbers and tomatoes to snap peas and amaranth, a leaf vegetable similar to kale. The challenge, he says, is educating families on how to prepare certain foods they may have never seen before, and to make it in such a way their children will actually eat.
That's absolutely valid. There still has to be some sort of ongoing conversation about like how to use this food, or like what's a good way to, you know, turn this vegetable into something that's tasty.
To that end, Veggie Oasis provides menu cards to aid the uninitiated and help ensure the produce doesn't go to waste. So how big a problem is food waste in the U.S.? Aaron Kennedy, manager of the Center for Healthy Lifestyles at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington, notes that Americans spend $218 billion planting, growing, and hauling food that never gets eaten, even though 48 million in the U.S. are food insecure.
And that's not just other states. That's right in our community, right in Bloomington, right in Chenoa, the two cities that struggle the most in McLean County with food insecurity. It's happening.
That comes from a recent study done by the McLean County Wellness Coalition, a group of business, health, and social service agencies which addresses food insecurity, obesity, and other health concerns. Kennedy says we're often a victim of our disposable culture. She says education might help prevent us from being so wasteful.
Whether it's an education or, if you use the sniff test, and that's the educational way of saying it, but think about the sell by, use by, best by labels on foods and really understand what those mean.
A local food safety expert agrees. Linda Fouch is a food program supervisor with the McLean County Health Department.
Sell-by dates, use-by dates, expiration dates are not all the same thing. There's aren't many true expiration dates based on FDA food code.
Fouch's mission is food safety, and even she says we're too quick to dispose of food that's perfectly fine.
And I understand that, especially when you see that people die from food poisoning, foodborne illness, hospitalizations, death.
Fouch acknowledges some circles of people ignore serious food safety risks, such as drinking unpasteurized milk, which is blamed for recent E. coli outbreak at a Tennessee daycare. She adds there are no regulations against grocery stores or restaurants donating unused food to charities. One exception, she says, is state law prevents home canned goods from being served at a permitted facility because of the risk for botulism, a rare but serious illness caused by a toxin that attacks the body's nerves and can be fatal. Fouch says when it comes to taking donated food, it's receiver beware. She recently told a local pantry it should throw out a package of raw meat that was donated in a trash bag.
Garbage bags are for garbage. They're not food grade. They're made from a recycled plastic that can leach those chemicals that were in that plastic into the food.
And food waste is often a struggle for farmers. Katie Bishop and her husband Hans both left State Farm in recent years to work on the family farm known as Prairie Earth in Atlanta. She says her favorite crop is heirloom tomatoes, and the majority of them go to waste.
Up to 60% just end up in the compost or in my kitchen to use because I can't sell them because they're so fragile, they'll crack or split, and if we don't sell them, we don't have a cannery that we can just take them to process them that way.
Changes to the state's Illinois Cottage Food Act in January give producers a chance to repurpose their crops, such as canning or freezing them, or converting them into a jelly or sauce that they can sell to the public at their farm or at a market, which the bishops and the Prairie Earth staff do each week, hoping to reach an expanded and hopefully younger customer base.
I know, you're so strong.
Bishop says that has helped them salvage perfectly good produce that might otherwise go to waste. It helped them expand their business.
A second life. I might pull a little bit of the basil from the field that was meant for a wholesale customer to use in the pesto. But for the most part, a lot of this stuff is the less than perfects, the things that people don't want to buy, but are still delicious and wonderful.
Bishop says her most environmentally conscious customers will seek out the less than perfect produce because she says they know they taste best.
Our greens might have little holes in it from the bugs that have chewed on it, or the broccoli might have a little worm in it, or yeah, there's definitely a perception of a lack of quality, but I think it's actually the opposite.
Prairie Earth is in the process of creating a food hub, a giant freezer being built on its farm that'll enable it to store and distribute produce from other regional farmers who don't have the means for larger distribution on their own. And Bobby and Brandy Hansen of Normal credit the Cottage Food Act with growing their hobby into a business. They married her love of gardening with his love of hot peppers into something that took off beyond their wildest dreams.
We first started out, I thought maybe it was just a fluke, like our friends and our family are like, yeah, it's good, you know. But when people kept coming back and saying like, hey, you're going to have some sauce for us again this year? And then we're like, okay, maybe we've got something here.
The couple grows hot peppers at their farm in Leroy, but Bobby says the hottest of the hot, including the ghost peppers and vitales, are grown in their backyard, so we can keep a close eye on them. After initially exploring whether it was worth renting space at a commercial kitchen to create a hot sauce business and realizing it was too expensive, they saw the state law had changed that allowed them to sell the sauce at the Bloomington Farmers Market, where they had also been selling the peppers, but would have to throw away what they didn't sell.
At the end, we had a whole glut of, I would say a glut of other things, and we're like, all right, we can have the rest of these peppers. What do we do with them? Well, rather than compost them, we made them into a final sauce called Season's Finale.
And Bobby Hansen says that means no good pepper goes to waste.
More or less, as long as the pepper doesn't die on the vine, so to speak, we can use almost every single one of them now.
Brandy Hansen says the cottage food revisions have not only helped she and her husband grow a business that she hopes will soon pay for itself, It also helps them be better stewards of their own land.
That makes me happy because it makes me sad when I have to throw a bunch of peppers away. It's like, you know, I mean, they're your children. You've raised them from seed, and now all of a sudden, oh, you're just wasting it. I mean, it just, when somebody can use that, why do that?
And Brandy admits she's more than just a hot sauce maker. She's also become a fan.
I like them hot now. I don't do like he does where I douse everything with it. But, you know, I'll eat something. I'm like, you know, this doesn't really please me. And then I'm like, I need some hot sauce.
While these efforts are encouraging to the environmentally conscious, there's still a long way to go. The U.S. throws out close to 91 billion kilograms of food per year, more than the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Italy, and Sweden combined. That's according to the 2017 Food Sustainability Index, compiled by the British kitchen retailer Magnet. But the U.S. is not the worst when it comes to wasting food. While the average American tosses close to 300 kilos of food in the trash every year, Australians dispose of more than 360 kilos of trash on average. And Sweden isn't much better than the U.S. The most conscientious about food waste were Greece, China, India, and Russia. I'm Eric Stock.
No matter how much good food is prevented from going to waste, there will always be a component of food that gets thrown away, such as what's left on a plate or trimmings from the kitchen. The 20-year solid waste plan, developed by the Ecology Action Center and approved by the Town of Normal, City of Bloomington, and McLean County, sets goals for commercial food waste composting. In the studio to talk more about commercial composting is Ecology Action Center Executive Director Michael Brown. Michael, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having me.
The goal is to expand coverage of commercial food waste composting programs to include 50% of commercial food waste volume between 2027 and 2032. Additionally, one of the plan's primary goals is to reduce solid waste disposal through composting and other methods. What percentage is McLean County composting now?
So food scraps currently we're generating, and this is data according to the 2014 Illinois DCO Waste Characterization Study, with also data supplemented from our own research locally. But in McLean County, we're currently generating about almost 30,000 tons of food waste a year, so 29,410 tons. The percentage of that that's being composted is pretty small. It's nearly 10%, and so that leaves over 26,000 tons of food scraps that could be recovered or composted or, used to some benefit.
How do we know? Where do those numbers come from?
So the DCO waste characterization study that was performed in 2014, this was actually performed across the state, kind of county by county, and they actually went and did really in-depth waste audits. And so we, the Ecology Action Center, try and do waste audits both on a small scale, kind of the business scale, or sometimes on the municipal scale that we'll go and look at the actual waste composition of trash that people are throwing away. But in this case, they actually went much more in-depth, much more statistically valid than we're able to do, and actually went through and analyzed a slice of waste from the landfill and looked at all the composition. And so we have really highly detailed data as a result of that on what we are landfilling.
So what's the effect on the landfill of entombing celery stalks or pork chop bones or what have you?
Well, there's a number of issues here, one of which is the loss of valuable organic nutrients. And so we put a lot of resources into, you know, growing our food, producing our food, transporting our food, preserving our food, all these resources. But the food themselves, I mean, these are, valuable organic nutrients that when we waste food or even just look at the food scraps and leftovers that can't be consumed, when we put that into landfill, those are essentially being lost in perpetuity. People do have some of a misperception that, you know, anything natural, it's okay to put into the landfill, that it'll break down and it'll kind of return to the soil. Well, landfill is a isolated, closed system that does try and prevent decomposition, and it definitely isolates materials from the rest of the environment. And so to put food waste or other organic materials into landfill, it is going to break down, but it's going to break down very slowly in this oxygen-deprived environment. And so this is an anaerobic breakdown process, which happens very, very slowly. And one of the byproducts is methane gas, which is actually one of the more potent climate-changing greenhouse gases there is. And so in addition to the loss of these valuable nutrients that could be used instead, you know, as an organic fertilizer, but also we are contributing to climate change by throwing food waste into the trash.
Is it cheaper, or could it be cheaper to deal with compostable material separately then, in addition to the environmental benefit?
So cost is definitely a consideration. And so when we look at East Coast and West Coast major urban areas, places where, you know, landfills have long been closed and where they have to ship their waste, you know, a couple states away, in those situations, large-scale composting of food scraps is pretty cost effective. So around here, where landfilling is still not that terribly expensive, the cost of a food scrap composting system, a whole universal, you know, community-wide system, can be somewhat cost prohibitive. But we do currently have a system here locally. It's run by Midwest Fiber, that they do pick up food waste from a number of local businesses and institutions, and that is transported over to a composting facility in Bartonville, south of Peoria, and made into a very high-quality organic compost.
Which institutional food facilities participate?
Of course, ISU is one of the big players. They actually helped organize this system to begin with, traditionally the food waste went out to the farm in Lexington for composting, but due to a number of different changes, the actual composting now happens at that facility in Bartonville.
And we're talking about all food, aren't we? Steak bones, chunks of chicken, dairy, produce. How does a commercial composting facility differ from what someone may have in their backyard?
Sure, that's a really good question. And so backyard composting, we do workshops, low-cost workshops, encouraging people to compost, help them build a really practical utilitarian backyard composter, and get people going on the basics of composting. And so through our workshops, we're always telling people, you know, you want to avoid, you know, meats, dairies, high-protein things, high-fat things, any prepared foods, because these don't compost well in a backyard environment. It just doesn't get hot enough. You really want to stick to, you know, vegetable peelings, fruit peels, yard waste, things like that, that are much more easily broken down in a lower temperature compost environment. And really, you know, what it comes down to is these other things. You know, we're looking at these higher protein, high fat foods, both attracting pests, which we don't want to do, but also the lack of proper decomposition means that these are going to be growing pathogens. And so you could be eventually inoculating your soil with, you know, botulinum toxin and things like that, or at least the spores that could grow that. And if you're doing this for your food garden, then you're actually, you know, could be creating a pretty bad system there. And so looking at a commercial compost environment in contrast, which is what they have down in Bartonville, it's a very high temperature, very active composting system. They have a huge hoop house, which houses all these windrows of food waste and yard waste and other organic materials that are being composted, and they're constantly being turned by a machine. And so it is that aeration, it is the mass of the piles, as these are huge, huge piles of compost. It is the mix of materials, that they're looking properly at the ratios of carbon and nitrogen materials. All these factors combined, they're able to really get to a really high temperature and kill off weed seeds, kill off pathogens, and so it just makes for a really good product in the end.
Michael Brown, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Brown is the executive director of the Ecology Action Center, which developed the area's 20-year solid waste plan. Better Earth Compost, partially comprised of broken down food waste from Bloomington Normal, can be found at 4 locations in Bloomington. Find all of them and maps at betterearthcompost.com. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, when do musicians get political and when don't they? A story from John Norton. A Supreme Court scholar says the High Court's 5-4 ruling upholding President Trump's travel ban from Muslim-majority countries is consistent with the wide latitude presidents have been given to enforce immigration rules. Constitutional law professor Michael Gizzi at Illinois State University says the court chose to ignore implications, through the president's own words, that the ban was targeting a particular religion.
It really was a statutory interpretation opinion. It doesn't really expand presidential power at all. The travel ban refers to the executive order that Trump issued right after becoming president. There were actually two of them. And the ban is actually pursuant to the Immigration and Naturalization Act, the INA. And the act gives the president certain powers. And the bulk of the Supreme Court's opinion, the majority opinion, was focused on whether or not his actions, President Trump's actions, were consistent with that act. And the court notably found yes, they were, and pointed out the fact that President Obama, President Reagan, President Carter had all used the same act in similar ways, although not necessarily motivated by the same potentially animus towards a particular group.
Does that set a certain precedent, though, given that the dissenters felt that this was discriminatory in nature?
The case does a couple of things. On the one hand, the dissent argues this is all about discrimination and this is all about the First Amendment's establishment clause of religion. And Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, very clearly lays out all the reasons through the words of the president, which would lead one to that conclusion. The majority opinion, on the other hand, says, look, the president has this power. The act says nothing about whether the president has to justify why he's using this power. And Roberts, in his opinion, and to be honest, to be critical of Roberts, he ignores all of the context of what Trump was doing, the Muslim ban, for example. He never refers to that. He does a little bit later on. He's a little bit critical of the president. But his point is the law says nothing about justification. It's a delegation of authority to the president. There is a simple solution here. Congress could change the law.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the ruling, quote, turns a blind eye to the pain and suffering that the proclamation inflicts upon countless families and individuals, many of whom are United States citizens. Is that the court's responsibility, though?
We could have a long debate about that. I mean, if the – because probably no, unfortunately. I mean, a large part of me wants to say, yes, it is. But when I look at the Constitution, and as someone who studies constitutional law, I always think about what's legal and constitutional issues versus policy issues. As a policy issue, I think this is really bad on many levels. But there's a difference in terms of whether or not it's constitutional. Although here we're dealing with a statute, no one's challenging the constitutionality of the statute. The statute itself, it's an interpretation, was the president acting in accord with the statute? I'm forced to say he was. It's one of those opinions you read the majority and say, yeah, okay, he's right. Then you read the dissent and you say, yep, she's absolutely right.
Well, and Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote for the majority, said that this was not an endorsement of the ban on policy grounds, but simply that they could not prove anti-Muslim bias. And Senator Dick Durbin also issued a statement saying that the ruling fails to safeguard the principle of religious neutrality embedded in our Bill of Rights. And he has some strong words here, saying that history will not be kind to this president's policies or the Supreme Court justices who lent their names to this troubling ruling. Now, the executive and judicial branches are the two separate branches of government that were involved in this, and the legislative branch, which you had alluded to, has played no part in this so far. Is it fair to lump those two branches together? They're not coming from the same place, are they?
No, they're not. But I think the senator's correct in many ways. History is not going to be favorable to what the president's doing. And it's the president's own words that make it not favorable. Okay, it's the president's own words, his tweets, his speeches. Robert's opinion, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, I would describe as sterile. It's a very typically Roberts opinion. Okay, I don't think. History, actually, 5 years after Roberts has gone from the court, anyone's going to be thinking about much of what Roberts ever wrote. He doesn't do a lot of constitutional law. It's kind of frustrating at times. Yet, I can't, you know, the executive power issue, on the one hand, is a distinct question from the discriminatory issue. And the way the second executive order was written, it was done in a way which was facially neutral. And even though we know what was behind it, and that in and of itself provided him with the catch. There is something else, too. Had President Obama's nominee to replace Justice Scalia been confirmed, this 5-4 decision might have gone in a very different direction.
And Neil Gorsuch, of course, was one of those who was in the majority.
Fifth vote. He did not write in this, but he's in the fifth vote.
This was the first ruling the Supreme Court has issued about a Trump administration policy, the administration which recently reached 500 days. Is there significance to this ruling beyond that?
Oh, I don't know that there's a lot of legal significance, but, you know, from the standpoint of the politics of this administration, certainly the president's going to be and his supporters are going to be arguing that this, you know, this is justifying what the president is doing. And this probably the biggest significance is the ongoing, incredibly difficult debate going on about immigration right now. And this is placing a little bit of giving the Supreme Court is giving the president something here in the sense that he might not have otherwise as we're dealing with the immigration issues with the refugees and the separation of families.
And as we know, there has been little activity in Congress on that front, attempts at such, but nothing beyond that. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stonk talking with Michael Gizzi, who is a professor of criminal justice and political scientist at Illinois State. In the High Court also recently ruled in a 5-4 decision that the warrantless searches of a customer's cell phone location data is unconstitutional. And this in response to a case in which a Detroit man was sentenced to 116 years in prison for a string of robberies, which police were able to track by tracing his steps by tracking his cell phone. What do you feel the impact will be from that Supreme Court ruling?
This is a very important Fourth Amendment decision. And the Fourth Amendment, I'm a criminal justice professor and teach constitutional law of the Fourth Amendment. That's my primary area. The decision in the Carpenter case deals with what we call cell site location information tracking, CSLI. CSLI is where police get a subpoena, not a warrant, they get a subpoena to the phone company to ask for all of the historical records of how your cell phone has connected to towers. And by doing so, it gives a very, very accurate description of where you are. The Supreme Court in 2014 had ruled that police can't search a smartphone without a warrant. That was a major decision by Chief Justice Roberts. This case has been sort of in the wings. People have been waiting for this. Well, what's the next step? And this case says that the court will not extend what we call the third-party doctrine to cell site location searches. See, the third-party doctrine is a rule that was established in the 1970s that said law enforcement does not need a warrant to gain information about things which you have voluntarily conveyed to third parties. For example, your bank records. For example, your telephone calls. Okay, and the third party doctrine really gives a vast amount of power to law enforcement without anything other than a simple subpoena, which is issued by a court clerk, going to say an internet provider saying we want all of this person's internet searches. We want to know or every website this person's visited. In recent years, the third-party doctrine has been criticized by Justices Sotomayor and Justice Kagan in a series of cases, important cases. But this is the first time the court's actually readdressed the issue. And for the very first time, the court has said, we're not going to extend the third-party doctrine to CSLI, cell phone, cell site location searches, that are historical. Okay, I should point out, there are also real-time CSLI. Police have a tool called a Stingray, which mimics a cell phone tower and actually basically steals all cell phone activity, and it captures it, and then it sends it forward. But in doing so, it grabs the information in real time. This case dealt with historical CSLI, and as a result, the decision only dealt with that.
So that's coming down the pike at some
point? I would
point.
Think so, and I would think unless the membership of the court changes, I see no reason to believe that that wouldn't get struck down as well and would require a warrant. From the standpoint of individual liberty, it's pretty disturbing that police can put up a device. They could be, you know, we're sitting here on the quad of ISU, and they could be sitting outside with this device that captures all cell phone traffic without any warrant. Yeah.
Will this ruling, and again, we're still talking about the historical location capability, will that make it harder to prosecute? And will this prompt police to seek other ways to go after criminals?
I don't think so. I think the reality is what it does is it forces police to have a warrant beforehand. They have to, if they have probable cause, they can get that information, but they have to do other investigatory work. The decision was a long decision. It's actually longer than the travel ban decision, which is very rare for a Fourth Amendment case, was 5-4 with 4 dissents. And there was a long spirited debate about the third party doctrine and also about what my colleague Craig Curtis from Bradley University and I call the jurisprudence of crime control. The reality is over the last 40 years, the court has established Fourth Amendment law in a way that makes it incredibly easy for law enforcement to apprehend criminals while minimizing individual privacy rights. So crime control is first and privacy is second. We write about this in our book, The Fourth Amendment in Flux. And the reality is this case shows that there's still a great deal of uncertainty in terms of how the court is going to grapple with some Fourth Amendment issues, particularly those dealing with technology.
Now, this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock, speaking with Michael Gizzi, a political scientist at Illinois State University, who has spoken and written for years about criminal justice and specifically talking about the Fourth Amendment, protecting oneself from search and seizure. It seems as though Americans don't worry too much about privacy. We tend to overshare on social media. We don't read service agreements for Facebook and whatnot. Is that sentiment starting to change in America, have you seen, perhaps because of cases like this?
It's a mix. You know, I think in some ways we can argue that Americans don't – Justice Alito would want us to believe that we always sacrifice our privacy for convenience, and I don't think that's necessarily true. I make the – privacy is about, you know, having to controlling what information government has about you and whether or not, you know, government has that right. We make choices. You know, we go on Facebook. We make choices about how to share, what to share. That is a choice. Maybe it's not necessarily a conscious decision. You know, I have some friends, some people who make everything public. So everything they do is open to the world. Others who lock things down. That's a choice. I don't think because of new technology, we have to abandon all of our claims to privacy and privacy protection.
How do you think this ruling might affect those service providers, Apple, Facebook, Google, and the others who have fought for these privacy protections?
You know, Google and Apple particularly have become strong proponents for protecting the rights of their users in the last several years, particularly. I don't think this decision hurts them because it provides further strength to say that, look, you know, we do not sacrifice our There's an old Supreme Court case that talked about the rights of First Amendment rights of students in a school. And, you know, we don't sacrifice our constitutional rights at the school yard gate. I think we can argue I don't sacrifice my constitutional rights when I pick up my iPhone, and nor should I have to. And the iPhone isn't just a convenience. It's an important or the Android or whatever. You know, the smartphone is not a convenience. It is a part of modern life, for better or for worse. And the Constitution does have to adapt.
Illinois State University Professor Michael Gizzi talking with GLT's Eric Stock. Gizzi says he believes the court ruling on cell phone tracking is a victory for Google and Apple, who've tried more recently to demonstrate they are committed to protecting their customers' privacy.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night, and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Musicians are not normally prone to wading into politics, but they are showing their hand more often in the current political climate. The Austin, Texas-based Band of Heathens played Saturday night at Six Strings Club in downtown Bloomington. The band had been covering Neil Young's Alabama since last year. The song is a blistering indictment of Southern racism and segregation. Vocalist and guitarist Gordy Quist says when Band of Heathens performed the song on XM Sirius Radio, they dedicated it to Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Quist tells GLT's John Norton via Skype, a major reason for featuring Alabama was the resurgence of white supremacist rallies last year, including one in Charlottesville, where a woman was killed.
I've been just kind of dumbfounded by lots of things going on in politics for the last few years. That was going on at the time, and we started putting that in the set, and the response is good. I mean, it's Neil Young. It's a great song, and it's just amazing that some of the issues that he was writing about back then are still around.
Well, what kind of pushback did you get when you were playing it on XM? Because that's a different than performing it in front of a concert crowd, right?
Well, you're right. And we've gotten pushback. We've had people walk out during concerts, and we've had some people not appreciate it. There are some of these universal, or at least I would think they should be universal, whether it be racism or sexism or sexual assault. There are some bigger issues going on right now that are not being called out. And that stuff, if someone has a problem with me calling that out or having an opinion on that, I don't really care.
Swing low, Alabama. You got the spare change. You got to feel strange. And now the moment is all that it meant. Alabama, you got the weight on your shoulders. It's breaking your back.
Is this a new foray for you to be talking about and singing about political things?
I don't think it's new. I feel like it's our job to talk about humanity and the human condition, and generally the political side of things is not something we get super active in, but I just feel like it's kind of crossed a line in recent years to where we're not just talking about Republicans and Democrats, right? Which that's not my issue. Ultimately, I love that music brings people together, and we're trying to find common ground with people, because I do feel like that's when forward progress is made, is when you find common ground and come together over something you enjoy.
So on your 2017 album, Duende, you've got the song called Road Dust Wheels, a commentary on discrimination against migrant workers. What prompted you to write that song at that time?
You know, I actually didn't write that song. My partner, Ed Jurdy, we're songwriting partners in the band. We split the lead singing duties.
And he's one of the co-founders of the band as well.
Yeah. The two of us have been in the band from the beginning. Yeah, you know, that song actually was written long before the recent immigration stuff. I mean, that song's a few years old, actually.
Right.
So it wasn't written directly in response to anything that's going on right now. But I feel like obviously sometimes that stuff comes back around and still applies. And I think the song maybe took on some new meaning in light of some of the recent stuff.
They came in boats. They came in cars. I traveled halfway across the sky through the stars. Left their families and their homes. and their loved ones all alone, and the memory of their love lingers on.
Band of Heathens is a band that fits comfortably in the Americana genre. But, you know, you've got forays into country. You've got your tentacles in there a little bit as well. What I mean, is that a little uncomfortable at times? Because the country crowd in general, at least a stereotype, is that it can be a little more conservative, right?
So, I mean, it's not uncomfortable for me. I grew up in Texas.
What part?
I grew up outside of Houston. Well, I mean, I moved there when I was seven. I was a military kid, so I moved around a bunch as a kid. But I moved outside of Houston when I was seven. I think there's more common ground with us all as people, as Americans, than there is, like, you know, areas to have issue with or have a fight about. You know, I think that's honestly the biggest problem right now is the fact that we can't have a dialogue about these things. We can't be next to someone who thinks the opposite of us on some issue without it turning into this ridiculous situation where we can't even have a civil conversation. And that's, I think, you know, as a band, I hope that if we could change anything, I would just hope that we could change that about the current situation in our country. It's like, hey, we got to be able to talk about these things civilly, move forward, and again, like, find common ground. That's what I hope.
Gordy Quist of Band of Heathens on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Also on that 2017 album, Crack the Code, about her obsession with technology and social media. And first of all, Gordy, this is a beautiful song musically. This is really neat.
Thanks.
A window to the world in hand.
Lyrically, it's a commentary on what I take away as lonely people trying to reinvent themselves online. And I see a lot of that even in my own family, right? I say, well, that's not who my sister really is, but, you know, I mean, but she's trying to reinvent herself.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. You know, we all put our best self forward online, or maybe the person we want to be. That song was coming out of a place of looking at how we maybe create different personas for ourselves online, but also just our addiction to constantly looking at the phone, checking our, you know, Instagram feed or Facebook, or kind of like always checking in and not being present.
Do you have conflicting feelings when you're on stage and you want to say, just enjoy the show? You know, you don't have to watch it through your phone.
I do. You know, on one hand, I love that people want to video it and share it online. And, you know, I mean, that's great. I don't think that anyone's doing that out of any negative place. But I also feel like all of us, and this goes for myself too, you know, it's that our constant struggle today is being present, whether you're driving and, you know, not looking at your phone, or you're at a meal with someone, or you're at a concert that you should be enjoying. Like, in all those scenarios, I think the new struggle is, in the last few years anyway, is to be present in that situation and not be looking elsewhere at the other life that exists online somewhere for yourself.
Keep your profile up to date. How you feel, what you ate. Foolish grin everywhere you've been. Am I who I say I am? The zeros, ones, the tools of man.
This is GLT Sound Ideas with our guest Gordy Quist of Band of Heathens. Let's go in a different direction. Let's get you talking about some of the people that you have met throughout your career. I was doing the research on you, and I see you got to do an interview backstage with Sam Bush. You've been recorded by Ray Wiley Hubbard. Who are the people that you've run into, you've had direct contact with professionally, that you just wigged out, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking with this person?
You know, I had a handful. One of the things I'll never forget, Guy Clark is one of my favorite songwriters. I opened up for him solo many, many years ago, maybe 15 years ago, and ended up getting his phone number. And then that turned into being in Nashville at the same time. And he invited me over to his house. And
spent an afternoon with him. Obviously, he's passed away now, but he was building guitars at the time, and just had a great, amazing afternoon with him at his house. And I had no business being there. I don't know why he invited me in. It kind of just opened my eyes to, like, I mean, to me, he's a legend in songwriting. You know, he was just so generous to me, and I was just a nobody acoustic folk singer that that opened up the show for him solo. I carry that with me, you know, and just think about everyone that we get a chance to interact with. Like, if Guy Clark can be so kind to me and invite me into his house, you know, it just kind of puts things into perspective. Like, hey, there's, try to keep that in my mind. You know, sometimes at the end of a show, it's been a long night, there might be people that want to meet us and, you know, get autographs or, you know, do all that kind of thing. And I just try to keep a generous heart about that, just because I've had a lot of people be really good to me.
Gordy Quist of Band of Heathens speaking with GLT's John Norton. Band of Heathens and Miles Nielsen and the Rusted Hearts play Six Strings in downtown Bloomington Saturday night. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton and Eric Stock. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University's School of Communication.